show you where we've been. But first, I want to recommend to everyone a field trip. Elias showed me the bathroom in this building on the first floor, which is back around the hallway, and in the back of the building, it looks that way. But it has this image. And this image is made of shards of pottery from the pottery studio that were destined for landfill. And out of those pieces, a new creation has come. And not just any new creation, the creation of humans by God. So it's a replica of the Sistine Chapel, and several of you have said, oh, we gotta do a field trip back there. Probably it wouldn't work to go all at once. But it is there, and it does need to be seen, so thanks for that. I had not visited that one yet. I'm making my rounds. It's what you gotta do at Holton. You gotta make your rounds of all the buildings, all the bathrooms, and all the teas. So let me say where we've been and kind of point this to where we're going today. And I want to say at the outset that I want to thank you at the outset for all of your questions after yesterday's lecture and also during the course of the day. I've been picking up questions and picking up questions, and like I said, sometimes asking the right question is more important than coming up with an answer to the wrong one. So I really wanted to take those questions seriously and try to address some of them and give you some space to ask some more. Job is one of the most difficult ones in the Bible. And I do think Job doesn't have all the answers. We don't need to look at Job as the only book in the Bible, and that's a very good thing. But Job does ask some of the right questions. And you asked some fabulous questions yesterday, so I want to build out. But for some people who are getting on this bus for the first time, let's say where we've been. And I'll start, as I've started every day this week, with the story of the Carmelite monk, a nun, who, 80 years old, she's been reading the same texts in Scripture for about 70 of those 80 years. And a friend asked her, how do you find new insight in the same old text that you've been reading over and over again, day after day? And she looked at him and she said simply, I read the text until it surprises me. I read the text until it surprises me. And I think that's very helpful because particularly when we circle back to Job today, we understand ourselves as a people who we want no surprises. We want a world with no surprises. And we get a God full of surprises. We want a world with answers. And we get a God who asks a lot of questions. We want a God, and I think this is particularly pertinent to where the discussion ended yesterday. We want a God in a way whom we can control, or who will be somehow predictable to us, and we get a God whom we can't control. And who is about, how is God predictable? I think God is faithful, but maybe not on our terms. So that's the hard news I think we get from Job. Now, as I was looking at these texts, these creation texts in Genesis, over and over and over again, and reading them in preparation for this Bible study, the surprises that came to me were twofold. First, I think God creates the world in three ways. By invitation, God calls creation out by invitation, and then by naming, and finally by blessing. The refrain of creation, like the refrain we sang yesterday, God is compassionate. God is compassionate to all creatures. And thanks for pointing that out to me. That is the refrain of creation. Only in the Genesis story, the way it goes is God says, and it was good. And it was good. And it was very good. So that's the first surprise. God creates not by command, but by invitation, by naming, and then by blessing. Okay, and surprise for me is that God leads this new creation that God has called out by questions. And I'm happy if all you remember from this Bible study are the five questions in the book of Genesis, because I think you can serve these questions for a life. And the first question, we'll hear it again today when we return to Job. Where are you? Where are you? It's a question of location, but not just physical location. Where are you spiritually? Where are you emotionally? Where are you politically? Where are you particularly in the themes of this conference? Where are we on the planet Earth? So that's a really important question. And then the second question, who told you that you were naked? Who told you that you were naked? Who told you that? What kind of scripts are we living out in our personal, our communal, our relational, our public lives, our lives as earthlings? And who told us that? Who told us we could use the earth like we use toilet paper or Kleenex or some kind of disposable? Who told us? And what are we hearing from the Creator? What messages are we hearing from the Creator? Then the third question, what have you done? What have you done? And this is a question that God poses to Eve. And I'm reading these texts as great literature. Maybe they happened, maybe they didn't. They tell us a truth that we have access to only in great literature. So what have you done? And Eve blames the serpent. Eve blames Adam. Adam blames Eve. Blaming. Really interesting. And really characteristic of human nature. And Adam even blames God. This woman that you gave me. Okay? So blaming. Remember that, because that's going to come up again today. Then again, why are you angry? This is a question God poses to Cain. Cain is myth that his sacrifice has not been acceptable to God, and Cain is angry, and beneath that anger is fear. Fear of not being good enough, fear of not being a favorite, just raw fear. And then the final question, where is your brother? And this is a question God asks Cain. Abel is missing, and God knows. So these are the questions of the first creation, and these are questions that you can serve for a lifetime. The second stop we made is a pattern that you notice in this first creation story, the creation in Genesis. And it's a pattern of breaking and remaking, like the shards that form the Sistine Chapel, like the shards of pottery that form that image of the Sistine Chapel on the bathroom in the back of this building. The creation of the world is a process of breaking and remaking. Creation happens only out of the broken pieces of something else. And we see that for us to have day, day has to be sheared off from night. For us to have moon and stars and sun, there has to be some separation and breakage of that smooth stone of matter. For there to be Adam and for there to be Eve, Adam has to be broken into. And for there even to be Adam, Adam has to be broken out of the earth and made into a human creature. So there's a lot of breakage in this story of creation. And yet, out of these pieces, a new creation happens. And that's good news and bad news. Because, as I mentioned, the new creation is never the old creation won over. The new creation is always that simply new. And, you know, it strikes me as I was thinking about this last night and listening to some of your questions, I'm trying to follow my own Bible study here. I realized that probably the most terrifying words in the New Testament are words that are saved till the very end. And they're words in Revelation: "Behold, I make all things new." I'm wondering how often, I say I want new things, but really I want the old things back again. And I say I want a new life, but really I want my old life in the body, in my old body. I'm sorry. So that's what we really yearn for sometimes. Behold, I make all things new. So in navigating this new creation, I just wanted, you know, four guidelines. Take it slowly, because you never know what day of creation you're in. It could be day 2 or 4 or 7. But there will be morning, and there will be evening. Or there will be evening, and there will be morning another day. Right? And then expect blessings. This is God's pattern with all of creation. Expect blessings. And we'll look more at blessings today when we get to Matthew's Gospel. Because blessings always come. God calls by blessing, and we call God by blessing. And blessings leak. That's this peculiar character. They cannot be contained. It's like ink that came out from a pen in your purse or your pocket or something like that. Blessings leak. And the third thing is blessings are kind of irrevocable. They cannot be taken back. The stain is very deep. The stain of blessings. And that's great news. So, I'm talking like Carla now, all right? Yeah. I thought that was really, all right, so. And then practice resurrection, which is not resuscitation. The old life is not coming back again, the new life is happening. And then finally, embrace the breakage. It's the stuff of the new creation. What I wanted to talk about yesterday is Job as an alternative story of creation. Because in the Genesis accounts, it seems when God shears off day from night and shears off dry land from the dome of the dry lands and the dome of the sky and the dome of the waters, when all of this breakage happens, it seems like there is a place for everything and everything in its place. And what we get in the book of Job is a kind of alternative story of creation where things are a little more transgressive. There seems to be a lot of trespassing in the book of Job. And in fact, what happens to Job is that Job is afflicted. His wealth is taken away, his land is taken away, his servants are slaughtered, his children are slaughtered, his cattle and camels and all of his land has slaughtered. And Job, who was once at the center of the universe, whom everybody consulted and everybody respected as a righteous man, is now at the periphery of civilization. Because he has leprosy, he can't even stay in the city. And he has to go where all lepers went, outside the city gates, because a skin disease was something that could contaminate the city, and that cannot happen. So Job is now on the margins, as I mentioned, and this fits in with some of the work Janine is doing. Job's friends come to him, and first, they provide us with a very good example of how to deal with grief when somebody else is grieving. You simply go there and be present. And for 7 days, Job's friends come to him, and they tear their hair, and they put ashes on their head, and they sit with Job in his misery, and they speak not a word. And that's a good way of being with someone inside. Of course, all hell breaks loose when they open their mouths. On the 8th day, they start talking. And they start trying to explain things, and they ask Job, is there not someone's secret sin somewhere, some secret sin that you haven't told us about, that no one would know, that perhaps we should know about? And Job keeps proclaiming his righteousness. I have it. And Job also keeps yelling at God. All right, now maybe this is whining. Ralph was saying, well, I think Job comes pretty close to whining, and why me? But I want to assert that Job never loses his agency in all this. He is always saying, I want to know what's going on. I am asking you for an answer. I'm going to curse the day I was born. I don't care what. I don't want you to curse it. I'm going to curse it. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return. It's extraordinary. And even at the end, and hold this in your head, at the end of the Gospel of Job, I keep calling it the Gospel of Job, well, I think there's something going on here. But at the end, Job says, my eyes see you. I have heard of you by the hearing of your ear, but now my eye sees you. And this is actually something Job has longed for all along. He says in his wonderful lament in the middle of the book of Job, I know that my Redeemer lives, and I believe that in this life I shall see God. And Job says that in the middle of his lament and at the end of the book of Job, after this speech from the whirlwind. I do have a picture of the whirlwind. After this speech from the whirlwind, Job says, now my eye sees me. So in a way, Job has gotten what he longed for. But we also are assured that Job's words have not been unheard. And that divine speech from the world, you know, Job's friends are all talking about God. Job insists on talking to God. And I think Job is a great model for us of how we can both hang on to God and yell at God at the same time. Because if you're yelling at somebody, there's got to be somebody there to receive the rage. And there, God is like that. God can answer. And in fact, God wants us to speak to God. Speak to Him. And I mentioned yesterday, it seems relevant here, so I'll mention it again. I think this is why Jesus says again and again in Scripture, ask for what you need. Prayer is asking for what you need, because prayer always invites us to say, I want, I need, I beg of you, I'm pissed off with you, I rage. And I think that's the relationship we get with God. I'm not sure we can embrace that, but it seems like Job offers us the possibility of a full-bore, full-body relationship with God that includes everything a human relationship with someone we love very deeply. Deep love, deep pissed offedness, deep rage, deep abandonment, deep, deep, deep. Full bore, full body, okay. So let me pause here and ask, I want to build this out a little bit more. We'll come back to the behemoths. But the way I ended yesterday, so this is a little moment of relief. I suggested Job, on the periphery of civilization, Job has simply joined the wild things. And as God speaks from the whirlwind, we hear of all of these wild creatures whom God has created, the wild ass, and the leviathan, and the behemoth, and all of these strange and amazing creatures who serve no purpose to the human project, whom God refuses to control. They don't stay where they're supposed to stay. They don't eat what they're supposed to eat, and they don't sleep with the creatures they're supposed to sleep with, I'm afraid. So these are creatures who violate all of the rules set up in the first account of creation in Genesis, and are out of control. They don't do the right things. The ostrich is a terrible example of parenting, and Job has tried to be such a good parent, sacrificing for his children, even when they, just in case, they commit. And the ostrich doesn't even care for its kids. But God delights in all of this creation, okay? And it's on the periphery of civilization, and now Job's God companionship, and Job's God, God's delight, and God's love. So, and Job has become, as I tried to suggest, one of the love things. So let me pause for a minute and see if there's any reactions or any questions. That's where we've been, you peeps, who are nuevo to this roadshow. That's where we've been. I want to pick up some pieces, some summaries of the questions I heard, but let me ask the people who were here yesterday, any other questions you want to pose? I'll make space for this at the end, but anything you want to ask now. Are we all here? Have we all been at the same Bible study? It's always interesting. This is kind of like, you know, a family snapshot album. I think they're snapshots largely because, you know, it's the only way people can prove. There's so many different stories. It's that 4th of July picnic. That a snapshot or a photograph is the only way you can prove everybody was actually at the same place together. Because the stories would suggest not. It's why we've got, you know, did you ever wonder why we have 4 Gospels instead of 1? And 5 if you want to add Paul to the mix. I'm not sure we should. And 6 if you want to add Job to the mix. But then let's add Ruth, the Gospel according to Ruth. And I see up here the book of Ruth from Paul's class. Any questions from yesterday, or do you want me to? Please. Yes.
I can deal with God and Satan having a little bet over Job.
Yeah.
And the treatment of Job. What really bothers me is the collateral damage.
Say more.
His wife,
his children, and his servants, his animals were slaughtered. That's just collateral damage. Nobody cares about them.
Yeah.
And I would hate to think we have a God who is so uncaring as that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to prove a point over here, and the rest of you guys, we don't care about you.
I agree. Oh, one correction, Job's wife doesn't get included in all of this mess.
Okay.
She survives the carnage, but there is a lot of carnage. And that seems to have been, thank you, you've summarized a lot of the feeling in the room yesterday. There is a lot of carnage. And, you know, who do we blame? Do we blame God? We want somebody to blame. We want somebody to blame. I completely agree. And why isn't God in charge of this? I mean, those are the questions that Job is in his lament shaking his fist at God and saying. Any other? Yeah.
Well, we also had this, I don't know if it's a question, more of a wonderment.
Yes.
Journey Job was on this transformation into suffering and marginalization, and then comes at the end of the story to being gifted with
all this stuff,
and you wonder, well, what is his transformation? What is his new creation? How
right.
does he see the world differently? And how does he do?
Yeah. And the question, I don't want to lose the question you asked me yesterday on the porch. You know, does Job is he able to translate his own personal misery and into a kind of compassion? We talked about the God who is compassionate to all creatures, to other creatures. Is Job able to be compassionate? Does he learn anything from this? Yeah, that's a really important question. And I think, I do want to deal with that, because I think that's a really important question. I think Job moves from being, you know, sort of curved into himself in this suffering. He is kind of in a fetal position after this happens, and who wouldn't be, you know? But then Job, in his lament, by chapter 19, Maybe we should sort of look at this now. Job asks God, why did the wicked, this is chapter 19, verse 7, I'll read it, no need to look it up. Why did the wicked live on, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? Their children are established in their presence, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and no rod of God is upon them. And it's kind of like, we'll hear this lament in the Psalms again and again. Why do the wicked prosper and the righteous die? And Job is asking about himself also, because he was not a wicked man. And the wicked are thriving, and Job has, Job is suffering. So why isn't this a universe of a justice that would reward the righteous and punish the wicked? Why isn't it like that? And Job is able at that point in his suffering to see that other people are suffering too. And that the people who are not suffering are not necessarily some of the righteous ones. Any other? Okay, let me see if I can, and if your questions, let me see if I can capture some of the questions I heard yesterday after this session in a series of texts from Job that tell the story again a little differently with a different edge. I think it's interesting that what sets this whole journey off, the Job story off, and this is as so often happens in Scripture, is a kind of exchange of questions. And we don't get some really good answers with Job, but I think we get some really good questions. And these are questions that we wrestle with for a lifetime. Why do the wicked prosper? And why do the righteous suffer? Again, God's first question, we first hear of God in the book of Job asking a question, where have you come from? He's talking to the Satan, who maybe in the book of Job is less Satan as the serpent, but kind of a divine FBI officer or CIA officer. I was interested in the way Carla put this yesterday. What is it, the Christian police department? The Satan in the book of Job is the head of the Christian or the police department, the heavenly police department. And the Satan, you know, God asks the Satan, where have you come from? And the Satan says, it's a great one, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down. So he's kind of been doing surveillance. You know, the Satan is out there kind of taking notes and keeping tally and looking at who's righteous and who's wicked. I think, in fact, Job and the Satan have more in common than meets the eye. And why is that? Because God says, have you considered my servant Job on your journeys of all this note-taking and tallying up the righteous and the wicked, the unrighteous, and blah, 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 okay? Have you considered my servant Job? And then the Satan, this, you know, divine, celestial FBI or CIA officer says, does Job fear God for nothing? And that's a text worth kind of reading in full. Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a fence around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. This is kind of extraordinary, and I missed this when I prepared for the presentation, but I certainly heard it in the aftermath of yesterday, okay? And it seems to me what Satan is posing to God and to us is that we only love God because God blesses us. It's all instrumental. We love God only and as long as things are going well. We love God because God is a good meal ticket. Or Job loves God because Job has prospered. It's an extraordinary accusation. And it's an accusation both of Job and also of us. You know, your kids only love you as long as you're going to be, as long as they get their allowance, or as long as you're a good meal ticket. They only love you. They only love you because you can support them. They only, your wife, your husband, your partner loves you because that's a fear. And it's the fear that we are just instruments, that love is somehow conditional. And I think Satan is really posing, thus Satan is really posing the question, Job only worships you because you're good to him, and Job will only worship you when you're good to him. Tell me how you're feeling about that. Yeah.
When I saw that yesterday, the common style response is that if we don't have free will, we have to have free will.
Yes.
That always seemed like thin soup.
Thin soup, we have the
well, it just it seemed a little formulaic. But when reading verse 9 and 10,
mm-hmm.
you sort of have to wonder if it's possible to know God from behind the fence.
Oh my gosh. Well, then the question is, what happens when the fence comes down? Is there a part of God that we only know through suffering when the fence comes down? Or do we actually want God to be fenced? And we want God to keep the fence. We want a fence between us and God. And I think what we get from Job is the possibility, or the suggestion of the possibility, of loving God even in the midst of suffering. Let me just pose the question now. I think the hardest question for Job at the end of the book is, can Job love his daughters, his new children? You know, the three beautiful, most beautiful women in the world, knowing that what if the Satan takes them away again? Can Job love again? And I think that's a really big question. That's a really important question. Who can we love God with the fences down? It's difficult.
It's like God in a box.
Well, and God doesn't want to be in a box, and actually we don't want God in a box either. Let me say this about that. God does and doesn't respond to the Satan's challenge, all right? Because the Satan challenges God to curse, you know, take all this away, touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. And God refuses to take away the blessings of Job. It's rather Satan that takes away the blessings of Job. The Satan is allowed to touch Job, except for his life. God puts constraints around the life of Job himself. Actually, that's the only way the puzzle will be solved. But it is important to note that thus Satan inflicts these things on Job. God refuses to touch Job, to do anything to God's self. But God also doesn't intervene. And I think this anger came up yesterday. God also doesn't intervene. Does God authorize it, as Ralph suggested? I don't want to go that far. Let's just say God steps back. And actually, I want to, this came up in a conversation with Linda at the table. I think we actually want God to step back. The only way humans can have free will is if God somehow steps back and does not control our every movement. And we do want, I think, a God who is a puppet master, but we also want a God who will protect us. And in some ways, according to Job, I don't know that we get that. Yeah.
I often ponder the sort of popular understanding of blessing to equal stuff or good health or happiness.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been so blessed.
Yeah.
Does that mean that so-and-so who's ill over here or who's lost everything with the economic recession not blessed? Does that mean they're condemned, but I'm blessed?
That means that blessing in the world according to God is very different from blessing in a world according to Job. I mean,
that's how Christians use the term.
Yeah, and I think we're constantly challenged to rethink blessing. Because if you look at, we're going to get at least a little bit to Matthew today. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now, we do get the promise that their fortunes will be reversed. All right? But we don't get the blueprint for how they're going to be reversed. We get instead blessing not as possession and as things, but blessing as a person.
It makes me wonder how the story of Job would have ended if all that reward wasn't visited upon Job.
If all the reward wasn't visited upon, what's the reward?
Yeah, at the end of the story.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, and we don't know the answer to that question. I think that's a really interesting question. And we actually, this is really interesting, we don't hear anything more from Job. Mm-hmm. At the outset, he said, now I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, and now my eye sees you. And that's the last we hear from Job. All we know from Job is that he has three beautiful daughters, and we are told that he's named them Jemima, Keziah, and Karen Heppa. Gorgeous names. Job, we don't know the names of Job's prior daughters. We don't know that. We know the names of his present daughters, and that's pretty interesting. He learned something. He learned enough to name his daughters and name them beauty, beautiful things. We know Job learned enough to not give his daughters slaves. He gets everything back, but we're not told he gets his slaves back. Did he learn something? We're not told that Job was actually healed of his skin disease. Not told that.
Well, there's also evidence to suggest that the original ending was not, this happy ending was added later at a later time. So the original version did not have this happy ending.
Yeah.
So someone later on added this, didn't feel that this ending could stand.
Well, they did a pretty good job. But, they knew enough not to put any more poetry in there. Because I don't think any second author, synonymous author, could have matched the poetry of the first. When does that ending get attacked? I don't know when the ending attacked on, but what chapter does the ending attack on?
42.
Couldn't match the poetry of the other 41 chapters. This is some of the best stuff in scripture. And I don't say that all the time. I don't say that all the time like Paul does. let me your question was next, please.
Does God change in this story?
Oh, that's a very good question.
Satan asked, had we not put a fence around him, was God domesticating Job, a fenced being? Because at the end he tells us he becomes a wild thing.
He becomes a wild thing, yeah.
Does God change in his relationship with people?
I don't know the answer to that, but that's a really good. And if we look at that snapshot of Job and the people who were creating it, I'm trying to pitch that up against the God who then takes on human flesh to experience nothing more and nothing less than the suffering of Job. Okay, so if we look at the trajectory of the stories that talk about this kind of God, see that the next step of this kind of God is, well, I guess I better experience this in my own flesh. And that seems to me a change. because what we see in Jesus is a God who has taken on that suffering, right? Right down to the abandonment. And that's how I would fit these stories together. But I think in the book of Job, just as a literary unit, what we get is a God. What we get is Job, whose conception of God changes. He thinks God is a God who plays by the rules. He thinks God is a God who ought to play by the rules. And he gets a God who delights in things that break outside the rules. And I gotta say, finally, that's the kind of God we need. That's the kind. Because we've all stepped outside the bounds, yes? I don't want to hear about it, but it's out there. I know I have, and I don't want to tell you about it. But I know I have, and I need a God who both knows that deep suffering and is not going to penalize me for it, and is going to love me in spite of it. I want a God who's going to hold me in spite of the chaos. And I think what Job sees is a God who holds chaos in her embrace and deeply loves it and deeply delights in it. And what we see is a God whose faithfulness to creation is that big. I mean, I don't want a God like that all the time, but I'm glad I've got it sometimes. And I think that's who God is. Another question. Sharon, you had a question.
Just a comment. So maybe the blessing that we, instead of the blessing of stuff, it's the blessing that Job receives in 42, and that is, I see God. Maybe that is the blessing that we want, and that's what we need.
Well, it's, thank you for bringing that up, because you're anticipating my slide, but I have to find it. Thank you for bringing that up, because I think Job does say, and this is the reason he's doing all this talking, Job does say in the middle of his lament that he knows, and his friends are all around him, you know, this is the middle of the lament, the middle of the book, Job does say, you know, his friends are all talking about God, and they're trying to say, well, God would do this if you had done that, and of course God would respond this way, so what have you done? And Job simply breaks into all this bullshit and says, I know that my Redeemer lives. Again, the I. I know that my Redeemer lives. And then at the last, he will stand upon the earth. He's got the gender wrong, but it's okay. And after my skin has thus been destroyed, and Job has boils all over the place, he's sitting on a dung heap, he's sitting literally in his own stuff. And Job said, and he's got, you know, boils. I know that after my skin has thus been destroyed, then in my flesh, in that very pussy skin, I will see God. It's extraordinary. But he does not believe it, that his own condition will prevent God from revealing God's self to him. So that is what he knows. And then at the end of the book, he says, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. So yeah, I mean, if the book ends there, Job has seen God. He knows that all of his lament has been heard, and he has also seen the God who has heard it. And it's kind of that moment of unselfing that takes him out of his own suffering, and out of his own need for control, and out of everything, and shows him the face of God. Now, here's the question. Nobody could see the face of God and live. Well, Moses did, yeah? You know who else did in the Hebrew Bible? Hagar. Hagar, an Egyptian woman who didn't even believe in the God. And God doesn't show God's self to Sarah. God shows God's self to this outsider. Maybe she's the only one who will believe. But Hagar knows that she has seen God, and she knows how holy that is. And Job has seen God. And this is a God who, this is good news and bad news. This is the God who is the center of the creation. And this is a God for whom we are not necessarily the center. Oh, I'm so sorry. We thought it was a Ptolemaic universe with me at the center, or the human project at the center. But unfortunately, that is just not the case. And God has spun out this incredible creation that does not necessarily serve us. And I wanted to go back. This is in chapter 38, but all of these things that are mentioned, these creatures that are mentioned, the wild ass, the behemoth, the leviathan, you can't, I was watching Alex fly fish yesterday up at Holden Lake. Alex is fly fishing, and how was I going to put that in? The leviathan, you can't. catch the Leviathan, you're not going to tame it. You're not going to tame the behemoth. These are going to trample down all human projects. But nothing that God has created is solely for us. All right? This is a great line. Who cut for the torrent a channel and a path for the thunderbolts to make it rain on the earth with not a person on it? Desert with no one there to satisfy the wild waste and bring forth a crop of grass. Rain comes whether there's anybody there to enjoy it or not. God would still send the rain even if there were crops to irrigate. God loves rain. You know, God doesn't send rain because it's important for our crops. God just likes creating rain and thunder and lightning. It's fun. And it seems to me that there's a difference between God's will and Job's. And this is the kind of central message. Job wants a world with no surprises, and there's a God of surprises. Job thinks God owes the righteous, and Job's friends think this, and actually so does the Satan, the divine police officer. You know, that God owes the righteous a good time, and God sort of says, you know, I love what I've created. Everything that I've created, I love it. It doesn't do anything except delight me. It serves no purpose but me. Job and his friends have kind of an instrumental view, at least the first Job. But I think Catherine is right. By the end of the book, Job's kind of into this delight thing. His daughters are kind of delightful. And the names of the daughters are kind of delightful. And you sense that Job is going to inflict, rather than righteousness on everything Job owns, Job is going to inflict everything with delight. Oh God, I would like the old Job better than the new Job. I would like the new Job better than the old. I think he'd be a great guy to party with. The first Job, I don't think so. But he'd probably be somebody you want. So anyway, I wanted to get this Annie Dillard quote in, and then I see one. I didn't read the question. The creator had loves pizzazz. Annie Dillard, Pilgrimage Tinker Queen. The creator loves pizzazz. So I think we get two very different worlds. But it really does challenge our notions of the way we think God is supposed to work in the world. I'm sorry I didn't.
No, that's fine. It just strikes
me. You're hiding in the corner of my eye.
Well, what strikes me is that God is both practical and, in light of what you've shared with us about your understanding of Job, who delights in everything he's created, those of us in our time who think so highly of usefulness, you don't need to take a step and look at the fact that, well, gee, my worth is not dependent upon how useful I might be or how I might contribute to the welfare or the growth or the progressive society, but because God delights in things that may not be so useful, just because he delights in them.
Well, let me give you a very self-interested response to that. You know, this is what I keep telling my mom, who has, you know, built her whole life on being useful to other people. And I keep saying, no, forget it. All you have to do is, you're the one who notices beauty in our family. Tell me about it. Make sure I hear it. You know, you don't have to do anything to earn your place in the world. You don't have to be useful to earn your life in the world. And I think that's what we need to hear. You know, what I think that's what we need to hear. Is my worth totally based on use? Did Luther not say something about this?
Well,
man, I don't know.
Well, the Western world, you know, is Greek.
Yeah.
And, you know, that thinking has to do with usefulness.
Yeah.
And not, you know, not the holistic view of the Hebrew world or the Eastern mystics, which is just simply be.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a great way to look at Job in terms of creation, of that creation.
I think it's a great way to look at Job too. I don't like it most days.
Yeah.
I want the old Job world. You know, I want virtue to be rewarded. You know, I'm trying to be a good person. I want those to be the only terms. Why did the wicked prosper? That's my question too. that's all of our questions. Do you see what I mean? Yeah.
Could you show the slide with the quote about the flesh and the skin?
Oh.
Yeah.
The flesh and the
skin. So the way I read this, and after my skin is thus destroyed, then in my flesh I see God. I see flesh as the muscle of the core.
Oh, that's very
interesting. And it just took the ripping off of my diseased, painful skin situation for me to actually be freed of that so that I could see God in my flesh.
And thank you for bringing that up. I think you're right. I think that God comes to us in flesh. In my flesh, I shall see God. And you know, I want to look at this has been used as a kind of prophecy of incarnation. Because God does come to us in flesh. And that flesh of Christ has been also destroyed. I mean, Jesus has gone through everything Job has gone through. Well, maybe almost as much as Job. He didn't have a lot of cattle to lose. He didn't have a lot of children to lose, at least not that we know about. But
the skin can also be seen then as the external trappings of my life.
Yeah.
And so when those are painfully ripped away, then what's left is
And I like where you're going with this. Thank you. Let's all keep thinking about that. Let's keep that as part of the conversation. And what you're making me think about now, and I'm kind of slow on my feet with this stuff, but is that there is a knowing of God and a seeing of God that comes through suffering, and some comes through great pain, and that those are holy moments and holy people. And I think we see that in Matthew's gospel where Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. I mean, he's telegraphing to these people in deep pain that they have a knowledge, they have a blessing, that this pain is not for nothing. It's an aperture to a face of God that cannot be seen otherwise. And God is there. I mean, not only there, but God is there. Suffering with God is compassionate to all creatures. The song that Ray, what we sang last night, I think you're exactly right. That's a refrain for all of this. Any other questions? We're clearly not going to get to Matthew, but we're already in Matthew. Yes.
Is everyone seeing the doubleness of that phrase? I saw my skin stripped away, and in my emptiness, my vulnerability, I stand skinless in my flesh and I see God. Or is it then within my flesh?
Yes.
Marty.
Thank you. Yes.
Marty?
Oh. Yeah.
I'm up here. I just want to say.
Paul, you're always telling me to look up.
I am telling you to look up.
You're always telling me to look up.
Mostly at the moment. Yeah. I just think it's brilliant that you compared this to Where the Wild Things Are, to a children's book. Because literature, and especially children's literature, gives us space to consider our worst fears. And it was an amazing thing. I read that book daily for 7 years. Then, you know,
and
they roared.
The years between 40 and 47.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the years my kids were those ages. That it's all the things kids are terrified of, that there will be no supper. And they roar their terrible roars and they flash their terrible eyes and you inflect it and act it out and the kids giggle. And for Job to give us space, for scripture to give us space, consider our very worst fears imaginatively. I mean, I think it's a brilliant connection.
God, I need to think of Job as the children's literature of the ancient world, but I think you might be right.
No, it's adult literature, totally. But.
Yeah, no, but I thank you. Yeah.
Those wild animals that represent figures of the fears that adults have, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not just children's fears.
And you get a truth from, you're right, you get a truth from children's literature that, in a way, is so raw and so true. And Sendak was onto that. And you know, he could refigure himself. He could put himself, he could be five in ways that are extremely insightful and also a bit terrifying. All of his stuff has that edge of truth to it that I think gets blunted by maturity. So when Jesus says, little children, unless you become as a little child, there is some truth we get back to as little children, that children know. And I have to say, really, in closing, how useless are children. They serve no purpose but beauty.
You and St. Augustine.
What?
Well, at St. Augustine, didn't you think women had any place? You and St. Augustine.
Me and St. Augustine.
I was trying to relate children
and
women.
Oh, yeah,
but that's
to
the
Carlos presentation. Yeah, no, it's not. No, children. But children are more than instruments. Let me just close this out. We'll do math tomorrow. We're not going to be getting everything we need. Thank you for pushing me, because this I had to do in strange and amazing ways. But here's I think the question this leaves for us. Can we love what we can't control? Can we love what we can't control? Can we, you know, we love our children, but we can't control them. We love our partners and spice, but, you know, they're sort of out of control sometimes. And then here's the reciprocal question. Are we loved when we're out of control? Are we loved when we're out of control? And the answer to all of that is yes. 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 Do you love me? Yes, I love you. You know that I love you. So I think that's where Job leaves us. And I'm sorry we didn't get to Matthew today, but not really. I mean, Matthew will still be there. For better or worse. Any final questions? We got about a minute. Upstairs. I'm sorry, I left upstairs. Yes?
There's a line in Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis.
Tell me.
Screwtape is writing the Wormwood, and he says, our cause is never in greater peril than when a mortal looks all around and sees no sign of God, but believes anyway.
Say that again. Our cause is never in more peril.
In greater peril than when a mortal looks everywhere and sees no sign of God and believes anyway.
That seems a good place to end. Thank you all. We'll pick up Matthew tomorrow. Thanks.